Manavyakya prakatita parabrahmatattvam yuvanam parashishtante vasidvrishiganayaravritam brahmanishtai acharyendram karakalitachin mudramanandamurtim swatmaramam mudhitavadanam dakshinamurtinide. On the verse 10, we did the first two lines last time. Maybe do the last two this time. Okay, you can repeat after me. Sarvatmatvamiti, Sarvatmatvamiti. Sputi kritamidam, sputi kritamidam, yasmadamushmin stave, tenasya shravanat tadartamananat, tenasya shravanat tadartamananat, dhyanat chasankirtanat, dhyanat chasankirtanat, sarvatmat. Mahabhibhuti sahitam sarvatmatva mahabhibhuti sahitam syat ishwaratvam swataha syat ishwaratvam swataha siddhyetat punarashtada parinatam siddhyetat punarashtada parinatam chaishwaryam avyahatam Chaishwaryam Avyahatam. You can chant with me if you want. Sarvat matvamiti sputi kritamidam yasmatamushmin stave tenasya shravanat tadartamananat dhyanat cha sankirtanat sarvat matvamahabhibhuti sahitam Syadishwaratvam swataha Siddhyetat punarashtada parinatam Chaishwaryam avyahatam. I'll just break the sandhi again if we did it last time. Sarva atmatvam iti sputi kritam idam Yasmat Amushmin Stave Tena Asya Shravanat Tadartha Tad Artha Mananat. So Shravanat Tad Artha Mananat Dhyanat Cha Sankirtanat Sarvatmatva Mahabhibhuti, so sarva atmatva, mahabhibhuti, sahitam, syat, ishwaratvam, swataha, siddhyet, tat, punar, ashtada, parinatam, cha, aishwaryam, avyahatam. Said last time that what Swamiji has said is that the Dakshinamurti Stotra is actually the first eight stotra, the first eight verses. And the last two are additional verses of praise and, giving the pala. Often there'll be the final verse will be something that will basically say, and if you study this text and understand this text, you will get these blessings. Mm-hmm. That's the Pala Shruti. It's called the Pala Shruti. And so this last verse is more or less that. It says, Sarvatmatvamiti sputi kritamidam. It says, yasmat, since, because this idam sarvatmatvam, the state of being the self of all. Or a better way to take this even, when you say the self of all, you have to understand that the self of all means that the self is all. It's not like there's an all which has a self. You know, that's also true in a sense when you're looking at it from the standpoint of satyam mitya, of the self plus maya. But actually, the self is all. Just like if you use the clay pot analogy, you don't say, like, the clay of the pot. We do say that. It's the clay of the pot. But there's no pot that isn't the clay, right? So the clay is the pot. And like that, the Atman, the self, is all of this. But all of this, which it is what we call mitya. It has no independent being. And the names and forms of this whole creation come and go, come and go, come and go, and are totally dependent for their being on the self. That's how you get the Advaita, the non-duality. Because this is certainly dual. The entire manifest creation is infinite duality, in fact. Time, space, objectivity. So you can't be more dual than the creation is, and all with its subtle levels and physical or gross levels and different lokas, different realms of experience, all of that is absolutely dual. But we say it is non-dual. And so to be able to say it is non-dual, that means that all of this duality that we experience, including the subject-object duality, has to have for its truth only one, that which is one, you know. And so that would mean that the truth of all this multiplicity that we experience is only one Atma, one self. Like the truth of the pot is only one clay. The truth of this whole creation is only one self. And so therefore, all of the duality that we experience that has duality, this duality that we experience through our sense organs and subject-object relationship, even though it has an objective reality, in other words, I can't wish the chair away. There's an objective reality and there's a laws, there's an infinite order to this infinite creation. If I go into what is the actual substance of the manifestation of this infinite creation, we say it is one non-dual Atma, one non-dual self. So here, that's the Sarvatmatvam. Tvam means that state of being, the state of the self being everything. So we say the self of all, I just want to make sure you know, but it's like saying the pot, the clay of the pot, this is the self of everything. Well, the self of everything is everything. There's no separate thing there. So the Sarvatmatvam, that state of the self, which is all, Sarvatmatvam, Sputi Kritam, this, yasmat, because this has now been made clear. Sputi, you know, here we are. We've done all these verses, right? We're at the end. So now this is clear, Sputi Kritam. And since it is clear, this is... Since, because it is clear that these verses have been clearly unfolded to you, they've been clearly unfolded, since the Sarvatmatvam has been clearly unfolded, Amushman Stave, in this stotram. Stava means the stotram, the verses that we call Dakshinamurti, so in this text of 10 verses. Since this has now been made clear, the Sarvatmatvam means the Advaita, the non-dual self that you are, has been made clear. In Amushman means in this stava, in the stava, in this stotram. Then Tena, therefore, Asya Shravanat, from doing Shravana, from the Shravana means from the exposure to this teaching. Remember that Shravana of the three, there's three what we call Upayanishta, or the Upayanishta is the sadhana, the primary sadhana for gaining self-knowledge. There's the what we call Upayanishta is the primary sadhanas for gaining Antakarana Shuddhi, means purity of mind. There are different means, like Karma Yoga, you know, and different attitudes and things that we can do to gain purity of mind. Those are one type of sadhana. But then that mind needs to gain knowledge, self-knowledge. And that's a different type of sadhana. The sadhana for gaining self-knowledge is shravana, manana, nididhyasana. The shravana means simply through the teacher-student relationship, the teacher teaching according to the sampradaya, the teaching methodology, unfolds the meaning of the Upanishads. Or the Prakarana Granthas, means the explanatory texts of the Upanishads, which themselves don't differ from the Upanishad. And so there's a teaching methodology which reveals what the Upanishad goes through very tersely, the nature, what the Upanishads are saying, and then gives all of the supporting logic why it's saying this and not this. In other words, why does this particular Shruti statement, the statement in the Upanishad, mean this and not this? So there's a lot of analysis that goes on in Shravana. But all of the analysis that goes on while you're receiving the teaching of the Upanishad or of the explanatory text, all of the analysis that goes on in Shravana is to make you understand clearly, to gain clearly the vision of the Shruti, what it is actually saying. Manana means an analytical analysis of why it couldn't be something else. Say once you understand clearly, you see, it's not just understand, you see clearly what the Shruti is saying, but then your mind will say what the Upanishad is saying, the vision that it's meant to give you. But then your mind may come and say, yeah, but why couldn't it be like this? The Upanishad says it like this. It reveals it like this. But your mind may have doubts and say, well, why can't it be like this? Or why can't it be like that? That analysis is manana. You see the difference? One is the Shravana means gaining clarity of the vision itself. Manana has to do with thinking about why, if you have doubts or any other different schools of thought, it'll, in fact, if you look at the Brahma Sutras or the explanatory texts in the Advaita Vedanta, what the Brahma Sutras will do in its second chapter is take every, what we call every darshana, every school of thought that was existing at that time that Shankara was familiar with, and go through and analyze each one of those darshanas, each one of those spiritual disciplines, whether it be yoga or Sankhya or different forms of Buddhism. And wherever there's a difference, then the manana will be to look at that difference in terms of what we call Purvapaksha Siddhanta. Purvapaksha means that the teacher has to, first of all, thoroughly understand what the other darshana, other system is saying. So that's the Purvapaksha. Either the person from the other tradition will present what they believe to be true, or the teacher themselves has to know it. That's the Purvapaksha. The Siddhanta is, in this case, the Vedantins' answer to that doubt. You know? And so there has to be a resolution. Is it this way or is it that way? Right? If it's knowledge, this is the idea here, is that for self-knowledge or the knowledge of reality, reality is what it is. You know? It just simply is what it is. That's what we mean. And what we mean by knowledge is that the knowledge that you have has to be true to that reality. So reality is whatever it is. Right? What is knowledge of that reality? Knowledge of the reality has to match the reality. That's what we mean by knowledge. If the knowledge of reality doesn't match reality, then that's not knowledge. We call that mithyajnanam, false knowledge. Mm. And so say a methodology or teaching tradition comes up, you know, which goes against the vision that the Advaita Vedanta has to give, then are they right or is this right? Right? Won't your mind think that? Like say, for instance, if you are gaining this particular vision of Vedanta and you're seeing it clearly, and then somebody else comes along and says, well, there's not really one self, there's many selves, you know, and all the selves are pure awareness, but each one of us has our own pure infinite awareness self. And that's what one school of thought will say. They actually do say that. There's a school of thought that says that there are infinite number of pure awarenesses, you know, and each one of us has one of them. Each one of them is called a Purusha. Each one of us is one, is that. And this physical world is something completely different. Or Advaita Vedanta will say, there is only one self, and this world, you know, has no being separate from that self. That's Advaita, that's non-duality. The other says, no, there's a physical world that has its own existence, and it comes from that Prakriti. Comes from the Prakriti, it manifests as the creation and goes back into this real Prakriti. And there are an infinite number of Purushas, of Atmas, that are associated with the body, mind, sense organs that are born in this Prakriti. Right? So they're different, you know? So a person can say, all right, they're different, but it's just different ways of painting pictures of reality. One school of thought paints the picture of reality in this way. One school of thought paints the picture of reality in this way. Another school of thought paints the picture of reality in this way. And so these are just different ways of relating to the experience that we're having. It's true. But what if they're relating to the experience that we're having in a way that is inaccurate to your own nature? From a Vedantic perspective, it's kind of like this. You're already doing that. We're already relating to reality in a way that it isn't. And when you're relating to reality in a way that it isn't, that isn't true to it, it doesn't work. Right? That's what creates a mumukshu in the first place. A mumukshu is one who desires liberation, right? Because they're relating to reality in a way that goes against their own nature. And so they're always seeking to become whole and complete. That's samsara. We're always seeking in some way to become whole and complete. So we would say, if in reality you are not whole and complete by your nature, there's nothing you can do about it. Because any amount of doing is taking place in duality. Any amount of achieving is taking place within duality. And so any achievement that is time-bound will come to an end. So there's all kinds of analysis that is necessary, because you have to realize also, what is the person striving for? What is a human being striving for? Are we striving to become temporarily full or temporarily complete? You know, in fact, that's what we get sick of. You know, to become always becoming temporarily happy, temporarily whole, and then realizing time and again, time and again, time and again, that the problem is not solved. Out of wholeness or out of fullness, let me experience the world, but let my wholeness or fullness not be continually compromised. And so, to recognize, in order to be able to say, I am whole or complete or full, period, then I have to be free from, my nature has to be free from time and space. If it's not free from time and space, if it exists within time and space, then the wholeness and the completeness that you are experiencing is something that's bound by change, because that's the nature of the creation. And so, if I am to discover, if there is such a thing as wholeness and completeness that I don't have to do anything about, that thing already has to be there. And if that thing already is there, it can't be bound by or subject to duality, because it's subject to duality, it comes and goes. So anyway, there's all of this, I think, all of this type of analysis that has to take place. And the different philosophical traditions that are there are going to be dealing with this in a different way. Different ways. Not in a different way. In different ways. Do these different ways or these different visions of reality work? Or are they just another version of samsara? You know, are they another version of temporary moments of completion? You know, so that's the quest. And so manana is when your mind is given a vision of non-duality, and then you say, but couldn't it be like this? The instant you say, couldn't it be like this, you're back in duality. You know, because there's only one non-dual. Non-dual, what we mean by non-dual is one without a second. That means, in spite of the duality that I experience, there is only one. That's non-dual. It's not non-dual. See, that's another thing that has to be understood, is that there can be all kinds of definitions of non-duality. You can say non-duality, there's one universe here, and everything is interconnected. And so there's only one here. There's one interconnected whole. But that one interconnected whole is something that is brought that is continually changing, coming and going, coming and going. This interconnected whole is subject to endless birth and death. Mm-hmm. And so everything within this interconnected whole, you know, is has no being and no substance at all. And so there isn't any escape for you from an infinite, complex, ever-changing, interdependent duality. That is the reality you have to come to terms with. Mm. Right? But you can't say that that is non-dual because it's an infinite expanse, you know, of interconnectedness. But to have something that's interconnected, there's two things that are interconnecting. You know? There's duality that is interconnected. We don't call that non-dual. You say non-dual is one without a second. It means there's the truth of it all. This creation, like say in some of the Buddhist schools, we totally agree with how they describe the Maya. They don't describe it as Maya because they don't have, I think they do have actually, but many will say they don't have, that underlying Advaita, the underlying non-duality where there is truly only one thing here. Truly only one thing here. Like if I take a clay relief, a big block of clay. So if I take a big block of clay and do a bas relief, you know, carving into it. Right? It's a complex carving of a whole scene, say a city scene with animals and people and bullock carts and houses and sun and moon, a whole complex scene carved into that big chunk of clay. We would say there's just an infinite number of things, countless number of things in that bas relief carving. But really, there's only one clay. All of those things are nothing but clay. That's Advaita. What if you say that the only thing there that is all of those interconnected things? Forget the clay, remove the clay completely. And then there's this interrelated connection of things that have no essence. Right? They have no essence because like an onion you keep peeling them and there's nothing there. Right? So you've removed the clay and what you have is this essenceless mirage or whatever you want to call it. But there's nothing inside. We say no, we don't accept that at all. We accept the mityatva or the continual changing and the infinite interconnectedness of the whole scene, you know. And the infinite divisibility of everything in the scene, even the peeling of the onion. We accept that from the standpoint of the name and form. But what is it that is actually there? You can't say that what is actually there is non-existence. Because if what is actually there is non-existence, like if I really were to pull out the clay of that bas-relief complex painting, the complex painting wouldn't exist. The images wouldn't exist because the being of them is gone. So we say that being has, that being is actually what is. And all of this that we experience, you know, all of this infinite duality is totally dependent on that being for its being. There's not a second being here. That's what we mean by the Advaita. If you take that away, if you pull the clay out of the bas relief, or you pull the sat chit, the conscious being, out of this manifest creation, then you are left with infinite interconnected duality that has no essence. So, okay with me, but the interconnectedness of the manifestation of duality doesn't make it non-dual. That's what I'm saying. You're still within duality. See that? So same thing with... And so if you're still within duality, the only way that you can really deal with that is to have an attitude toward your experience in the world which has basically to do with don't cling to anything. That's very interesting because in Advaita Vedanta... See, in the East, we have all of these things are similar. All of these types of sadhanas are similar. In Vedanta, we say, don't cling to anything. Why are you clinging? We have a reason. The reasons for the not clinging are different. In Advaita Vedanta, the reason not to cling is because the ananda or the wholeness or the being, you know, which you are seeking, isn't to be found in the names and forms, but is the very nature of the self, which is the truth of all names and forms, and not away from you. Whereas if you've gotten rid of that self or gotten rid of the clay from the bas relief, you know, then it's different. Then the one who is interconnected with all other beings has to have an attitude of non-clinging in order for the mind to be free of pain. It's very interesting. That also works, you know, but it's a practice. It's a practice. Like, say, for instance, I have a practice, like in yoga, of pranayama. That is a practice. It's a breathing exercise. And it's a very powerful breathing exercise. I do the practice of pranayama. And because the mind and the because the mind and the breath are very interconnected, if I properly practice pranayama, my mind will be quiet. Right? If I stop the practice of pranayama and just go on my way into the world, my mind will become agitated again, just based upon the problems that I'm facing in the world. So that is a practice. Non-clinging is also a practice. You know, it's a practice. I do that practice, and I experience the results of it. But the problem is that it's a practice that has to do with controlling the mind. Now, I'm not going to. There's a lot more to Buddhism than this. This is just kind of a layperson's Buddhism, because even the Buddha himself will talk about something which is very much like Brahman, something to be recognized. I'm not going to go into that. You know, there is something for you to recognize. There's something there to be recognized. But it's not something that words can point to or words can give you. And so when you're just looking at the practice itself or what they will give you about the nature of reality, it's an interconnected whole. It's one interconnected whole made of many, many parts, infinitely divisible, everything coming into existence and going out of existence, right? With no essence. These are subtle points. I'm not going to go on and on about this. Let me just make one more point about this, because I want you to kind of be able to think around these things. Both Vedanta and Buddhism will say about any given object that it is infinitely divisible. It is like, and will say, they're like names within names within names within names, and it goes in infinite regress. You can never get to the bottom of it, right? So it's infinitely divisible. We will even say it's like peeling an onion, you know? Except the only problem is we won't really say peeling an onion all just means that the thing that you thought was there isn't there. You know, there's something inside, something inside, something inside, something inside. But why we don't say peeling an onion is because if you have an onion, there's a last peel. You know what I mean? There's one last peel, and then what you realize is that there's nothing there, right? Well, for us, we would peel the onion, you know, but there's no end to the peeling in mithya. That you can't ever resolve that problem, because whatever you're peeling, right, is something that exists within time and space. Whatever you're taking apart, like say if I peel, like say if I take this thing and I break it into its respective, into its smaller parts, and then I break those parts into their smaller parts, and I break those parts into their smaller parts, that will go on infinitely as long as the thing takes up space. If anything, I can get to smaller and smaller parts, but if it takes up space, any space, I can divide it. Hypothetically, if something takes up space, it's divisible into smaller objects. If it doesn't take up space, it isn't there. Right? If it doesn't take up space, it doesn't exist. So as long as something is there, you know, and you can't take, because you can't take, as long as it's taking up space, it's always going to be divisible by two. You see that? As long as something, just hypothetically, if something takes up space, you can divide it in half. Now you have two things, and now these two things take up space. So you divide those in half. Now those things take up space. You divide those in half. When are you going to get to the fine, to the last division? It's inconceivable to get to the last division. So it goes into an infinite regress, right? But say you did get to the last division somehow. Say you get to this hypothetical object and you realize, this is not going to work for me to divide it. Let me take the form off of it. Let me just take the form off of it. You can't do this either, but just imagine. Then you take the form off of it. Then what you're left with is what is, in the end, the substance. Right, everything has a substance, right? Every form has a substance, something that fills it. So say I were to somehow take the form off of it, and then what is left is the substance of the form. But that substance of the form that is left is formless, is not objectifiable. It is, but it is formless, not objectifiable. That's exactly what we say. That which is and is not objectifiable is the sut, is being itself, is existence itself, is the nature of the Atma, is the nature of the self. And so you see how these kind of discussions go. This is the Purvapaksha Siddhanta, right? That is something that is carried on in India. They carry it on with all seriousness. They're not kidding around. In India, it's not all paths lead to the same goal. It's not at all, don't let me hurt your feelings by disagreeing with you. Neither side feels that way. It's an honest inquiry. Mm. It's an honest inquiry into what is the truth. You know, because in all of the different schools in India, you know, the one thing they have in common is that it is knowledge of reality that sets you free. Moksha. Liberation is knowledge of reality. And so now there's going to be a lot of things involved in any discussion about what is that knowledge and how can that knowledge be achieved. So this is all the manana, you know, that takes place. What are the means of knowledge available? Can you gain knowledge of reality through perception? Can you gain knowledge of reality through inference? Are the Vedas necessary to gain knowledge of absolute reality, or can you get there by inference? These are huge questions, you know? And the reason all these questions are so important is because of the conviction that what is barring you from moksha is self-ignorance. Or I would say, to be more general, ignorance of reality, and therefore that reality has to be recognized. And for Vedanta, it is, if you aren't free now, you can't become free, because there's nothing within duality that is free. Everything in duality is subject to birth and death, is subject to change. And that means any ananda, any fullness that you experience is subject to going. That's why the Buddha will say, in Buddhism they say, and in Vedanta they say, you know, all of this, all sukha, all happiness that you experience is only a dukkha yoni. Dukkha yoni means it's a womb for sorrow. It's a womb for sorrow because any ananda that you experience in the world, to the degree that it's dependent upon anything in the world, like I'm so happy because of you, or I'm so happy because of whatever, that's a dukkha yoni. Because whatever the whatever is time-bound. So if you're happy because that's your nature, and your nature is not subject to coming and going, you know, then you're free. But if your happiness is superimposed upon anything that is time-bound, then sorrow is a part of your nature, just by the nature of reality. So here the shravana manana and then dhyana, all of these things, the dhyana is the meditation, contemplation, nididhyasana, where when the not once a person does gain knowledge, then their mind is has to just sit and be with that over and over again. You know, because we have, you know, beginningless lifetimes of ajnanam, of being, of relating to the world in as a subject, in a subject-object relationship within duality. Everything that I think, everything that I know, everything that I achieve, I strive for, exists within this dukkha yoni, this world of dukkha. And I can't really do anything about that. You know, except the only thing you can do about it is to try to mitigate it through the practice of dharma, really. The practice of dharma and non-clinging. That's your best bet. Real, honestly, dharma and non-clinging. But there's no passage outside of duality if there's nothing outside of duality. Right? There's not a passage outside if there's nothing else, if such a thing isn't there. And if such a thing is there, if the non-dual is there, there's no passage because it's already a fact. And that's why the knowledge is necessary. There's nothing you can do. What can you do? Because it's already a given. So these are all... and if it is a given and you've understood it, then the mind has to continually own it up, you know, until it doesn't have to own it up anymore, just because of all of the endless samskaras and the endless tendencies to behave in the world in the way the world isn't. And so then, so after all of these things, then he says, Sarvatmatva mahavibhuti sahitan syat ishwaratvam svatah. He says, siddhate. That being, once that knowledge is gained, then this the ishwaratvam, the state of you being Ishwar, that you are Ishwar, means that you are the whole. You know, that comes along with the Ishwaratvam means my recognition that I am the whole. That this conscious being, the infinite conscious being that we call Ishwara, that I am that, that and that I am the whole, that Ishwaratvam becomes establishes itself naturally, along with the Sarvatmatva. That I am the self, which is all, and all of this is there for me, and all of the Mahavibhutis. All of the Mahavibhutis means all of the glories of Ishwara become naturally mine, which is a really all of the glories of Ishwara. That Ishwaratvam, that there is Ishwara, I am that Ishwara, and I am the self of all. And all of the vibhutis, all of the glories of Ishwara, the Mahavibhutis, all of the great vibhutis of Ishwara, those also become me. Those also are mine. So, if you're talking as a jiva, as an from the standpoint of an individual, and you say, you know, I am the jiva, this individual, I am the Lord, and I am the self of all of you. Talking as a jiva, I am the Lord. And I'm the self of all of you, and I am. I, all of the glories belong to me. Mm. Now, that is madness, right? But when you recognize that the self, that yourself, is the self of all beings, and that the self of all beings is yourself, and that the self of Ishwara is the self which I am, then you're not talking from the standpoint of the jiva. Mm. You recognize the whole Ishwara is me. This whole thing is me. That this jiva, body, mind, sense organs is part of the whole. Right? It's not that I, the body, mind, sense organs person, am Ishwara. The body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishwara. But I, the conscious being, which is the conscious being, which is you are, which you are, I am the whole, and that whole is me. Right? I am the whole that the Ishwara is not, isn't somebody else. It isn't somebody else. That's where, you know, using the imagination or the dream analogy is so important, or the my meadow, when I have ask you to imagine a meadow. The whole meadow that has birds and animals and people in it, including you, say you have a you've taken a body in the meadow. I ask you to please imagine a meadow and take a form in the meadow and have your friends in the meadow. And the animals in the meadow. You are the meadow. And the one that you say you've taken a form in the meadow, your person in the meadow, that person knows the jnani person in the meadow knows, I'm the meadow. And all of the trees in the meadow, all of the vibhutis, all of the glories in the meadow, all of the everything that's exalted, you know, in the meadow. What if there's some exalted beings in the meadow? Maybe there's devatas and angels and, you know, and really the super beings in the meadow of all kinds. All of those beings are me. All of the animals are me. You know, all of the beautiful trees are me. All of the glories that are there in that meadow, all of them are me alone. Mm-hmm. All of the capacities of all beings are me alone. Say there's a, you know how in the world there are people who have, what do you call, they're at the top of their field, whether they're tennis players or musicians or, you know, Einsteins or these we call all of these vibhutis, or the mountains like the Himalayas or the seven wonders of the world, these are called vibhutis. You know? So if there are certain people that have extraordinary vibhutis, beautiful voices or whatever they have, saintly people. You know? I am all of those. Those are my vibhutis. They're all the vibhutis of the Lord, you know. And so it's very beautiful, actually, because if you understand that, there isn't any jealousy, you know. That is a beautiful expression of me, you know. That is one of my glories, is Ishwara. You know? All of these things, all of the differences in the world are expressions of me. And this body, mind, sense organs also is an expression of me. All of our relationships, all that exists is an expression of me. You know, and so that those Mahavibhuti, so the Ishwaratvam is something that siddhet, it comes to me naturally, says Swataha Siddhet, comes to me naturally because it is me. And the commentary says, of course it comes naturally, because if you have to do anything, you're back in duality and it's time bound. That isn't what it is. You know, so even the Mahavibhutis, you know, of all of the superpowers of the yogis, even, you know, becoming large, becoming small, all of the siddhis of the yogis, those are also all me. Right? There is nothing. Those powers exist. The powers that exist, those powers are mine. So all of these things are me. And he said, and this creation, Punar Ashtada, it continues to come again and again. This manifest creation, it comes again and again in this eightfold way. The eightfold way are the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth, sun, moon, and jiva. You know, and the jiva, conscious being. There's many ways sometimes that the universe is divided into, you know, 26 tattvas and all of these type of things. This is one way it's divided in the Dakshinamurti. This whole creation manifests again and again. My glory, my vibhuti, you know, manifests again and again, and it says avyahatam, without any hindrance, without any effort, you know, without any type of pratibandhika, any type of obstruction. This infinite creation manifests again and again and again. So the Aishwaryatvam is the very nature of Ishwara. This creation manifests again and again as the very nature of Ishwara, without any hindrance, without any effort, without any obstruction, without any trying, without any effort. And that manifestation is with, together, the manifestation is the manifestation of Ishwara, together with the Sarvatmatvam, being the one self of everything, and having all of the Mahavibhutis. That is what is enjoyed by, that same is enjoyed by the jnani, the one who has this knowledge. Because to have this knowledge is to recognize, I'm the whole. Just think about it. If you have the meadow imagination and you're a character in the meadow, and you gain knowledge, what is the knowledge? That I'm the whole meadow. Right? Not only am I the whole meadow, I'm the truth of the meadow. Right? I'm the self of the meadow. But there's nothing there but me, the meadow. Everything that exists in the meadow is myself alone. So. So having made all of this clear, Sputi Kratam, he ends this Dachinamurti with this. It's a praise. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Catherine, I'm just seeing your note about the Wi-Fi. Nobody else seems to have had a problem. Maybe on its way to Washington, it's getting stuck. I don't know. Yeah. Broadband.
On its way to Washington.
Where's Catherine? Well, she lives Washington in the state. Oh. Catherine. Yeah. I think, Catherine, you live in Washington, right? Washington or Seattle area.
So this idea of seeing the glory everywhere in someone's achievement or the extra special qualities, mm-hmm. what do you naturally see when that happens? I mean, that
it gives you a lot of freedom to appreciate, mm-hmm. you know, instead of compare. You know, they're better than I am.
Yes.
Instead of seeing they're better or worse than I am, to see them as Ishwara.
So you don't feel small in front of that, you think?
You can enjoy it. Yeah.
So it's safe, it's both this is me and I am that. It's both of those, right?
Wait, when I said that, I was meaning something, but it's dangerous to say it that way. It's better to say like this, this is me and I am free of that. In other words, where I was coming from is that I, this conscious being that I am, is Ishwara, not the jiva. Myself, consciousness, is not bound or contained in the jiva, in the individual. This self is the one self of the entire creation. See what I mean? So that when you say I am, the me, your sense of self, that self is the same. It is the self of the entire creation. It's not, even though it's very personal, it's not that it's not a personal self, but the personalness belongs to the self. You think that what makes the self personally you is this physical body, but really what makes the self personally you is the self. And if I get rid of the whole body and the whole creation, this personal self is what is there. That's your very nature. See what I mean? So the self that is your being, that same self that one self is the being of the whole creation. Right? And so that's what I was conveying at that moment. But I usually don't say like that because I'm so usually unfolding, using those kind of words to unfold what we call satyam mitya. And satyam mitya means, what is the satyam is the truth of what is actually there, the substance of what is actually there that doesn't, isn't subject to time. And the mitya is what depends on that for its being. So, for instance, if I take the clay pot in that illustration, limited, which has its own limitations, but nevertheless, the clay is satyam. It is the substance that's actually there. And the pot is mitya, because it doesn't have any separate individual being. Right? The only being that it has is the clay. So I would say, and when I'm unfolding the satyam mitya, I would say that the pot is the clay, right? Because it isn't anything else, right? I have to say the pot is the clay, because what else is it? It's only clay. But then I can say, I have to also be able to say, but the clay is free of the pot. The being of the clay is not dependent upon the form pot, but the pot is totally dependent on the clay, so it's not the same going both ways. So, like, say, if you have a meadow imagination, for instance, when you have that imagination, the imagination is totally dependent on your being for its being, right? So the conscious being that you are is the very self, the very truth of the meadow imagination. And if you take that self away, there's no meadow there, right? So I would say, you know, the meadow is me, but I am free of the meadow. Because whether the meadow's there or not is totally irrelevant to my being. I'm not dependent on the meadow at all. So like that, I can also say the body is me, because I'm the very being that is the self of this body. So the body is me, but I am free of the body. If the body drops right now, nothing happens to me. You could say the mind is me, because I'm the very self of the mind. The mind is a conscious, existent being. But it thinks, this is the ajnana, this is the ignorance, it takes the consciousness and existence to belong to it, so that if something happens to the mind, or if something happens to the body, you lose the consciousness existence. Where in fact that isn't true. So you would say the mind is me, but I am free of the mind. And there's so many teaching methodologies that we do pointing to make you see that the conscious being, yourself, is never going through any variance at all. You are always exactly the same. No experience that you have ever touches it in you in any way. And so if the experiences come and go without touching your being has is what we call asanga. You know, it doesn't have any attachment to it. It's free in reference. That the objects are not free in reference to it, but it is free in reference to the objects. Like I say, it's so good to use, just play with the thoughts in your mind. And you watch one thought, you know, if this was like Vipassana, just to relax and let thought after thought after thought after thought come and go, and you'll start to recognize that there's something that has not touched it anyway. You know? But then those thoughts don't have, they're totally dependent upon you for their being, but the being never changes. So that's satyam mitya. The mind is dependent on you. It has you for its very self, which is its experience. That's why the mind can say, I am the self. It's true what it says. It's like the clay, the pot saying, I am the clay. That's right. But it doesn't know the other half of it, right? So you think, the mind says, I am me. I am me, I am the self. But it doesn't realize that the self is also free. I am also free of the mind. You know? So when the mind says, I am the self, you can say, yes, that's absolutely true. And you know what? And I'm completely free of you, too. Yeah. You are me, but I am free of you. Yeah. And that's your experience, too, if you just slow down to see it.
this phrase, I am that, actually never made sense to me. I mean, I have the book, you know, like, yeah. what does it mean, I am that? Even the word that feels like, I mean, it has a distance in it because it's this and
what
that.
What it means, usually he's translating this, I am that, but the what is usually said is tet tuamasi, means you are that.
You are that.
But he's saying I am that, but we can do it, but let's start with you are that, and then I'll go to the I am that.
Mm-hmm.
The I am that is really aham brahmasmi. These are what we call Mahavakyas. It's the whole teaching of the Vedanta is the Mahavakya. So there's many different Mahavakyas, there are four major ones, but he's playing with two of them, tat tvamasi, that thou art, and aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman. So now, just understand, if you say, you are that, it's like me teaching, say I'm a wave in the ocean, and I'm the guru wave, and I'm teaching the little student waves. I'm saying to all of them, you are waves, all of you waves, you are the ocean. And each, so I say to one, you are the ocean. You are a wave, you are the ocean. And the wave says, I can't be the ocean. I'm just a wave in the ocean. I'm a part of the ocean, but I can't be the ocean. Which is true, right? The wave form, it can't be the ocean. So that doesn't make any sense. But then the Upanishad is saying, you are the ocean. You, a wave, are the ocean. So what, and if the Upanishad is saying the truth, what is it saying? That the water that you are is the water which the ocean is. So here if you say, you are that, have the you is the jiva, and the that is Ishwara. So you, O jiva, you are Ishwara. How can I be Ishwara? I'm just a limited jiva, limited individual bound by birth and death. I only take up so much space in this infinite creation that is Ishwara. How can I be Ishwara? Because Ishwara also is not this upadi. Ishwara is not Ishwara. It's like saying, you know, Ishwara is not going to own as his being the Maya upadi. For Ishwara will say, I'm Brahman. You know, I am Advaita. I'm the non-dual Brahman. If you ask Ishwara, who are you, Ishwara? I'm Brahman, you know. Then you ask the jiva, who are you? Ask the jnani jiva, who are you? I'm Brahman. I'm the self, you know. So the tet tvamasi, when we're saying that, it's a type of lakshana, which is a type of a way of using words to give the implied meaning of the word. So if I say, you, O jiva, you are Ishwara, that's no way that can be true in the immediate meaning of the word, because the jiva is an Ishwara, the jiva is part of Ishwara, right? It means the body, mind, sense, it is its part. But when that's being said, then it has to go to the self that you are is the self which Ishwara is. Okay? So then say if you say, aham brahmasmi, aham means I am asmi, I am Brahman. So he's saying that I am that means I am the conscious being that I am is that consciousness which is Brahman.
Mm.
Right? So the consciousness which is of Ishwara is the consciousness which I am.
Mm.
So like if I say I am Brahman, that means I, this Atma, this conscious, the self, this self that I am, is infinite. Is infinite consciousness, is the self of all beings. Brahman means infinite, right? So I, this self, is Brahman, the infinite consciousness. And Brahman also, if we say, the self of the individual, this body, mind, sense organs, is called the Atma. That's the name for the self. The self for Ishwara is called Brahman, because Ishwara is infinite. So Ishwara's self is infinite, right? So this, the Atma of the individual, is the self of the individual, is the self of Ishwara. The self of Ishwara is called infinite because infinite consciousness. So if I say, I am infinite consciousness, right, that means that the self that I am is Brahman, is infinite consciousness. So that if you are infinite consciousness, if you are Brahman, then you are the whole, you are Ishvara. So when he said, I am that, it's the Mahavakya.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the experience of consciousness for Ishvara is the same as the experience of consciousness for the Jiva?
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
And of course, you don't have an experience of consciousness as an object, but the consciousness which you are is self-evident. It's not a subject-object relationship for your... For you don't look at consciousness as an object. There's not a subject-object consciousness of consciousness. Consciousness is self-shining. So there is only one consciousness experience.
Mm-hmm.
One self-evident consciousness. So this me that is me is only one illumining this creation. And it is you. That's why you say, oh, I don't want to be an impersonal self. I want to be a personal self. But you are the personal self. That's all that's there is the personal self. There's no impersonal self. There's only yourself. It says that yourself is the self of the whole. But certainly not impersonal, because it's you. You would never consider yourself the impersonal self. It's just that you think that what's giving you the sense of being personal is that your body, mind, sense organs makes yourself personal. And it doesn't have anything to do with yourself. Your self-experience is your self-experience. It's not given to you by the body, mind, or sense organs, or universe. If the universe comes and goes, it's cyclical. Yourself doesn't come and go. So it's not that the body, mind, sense organs adds an addition of personalness to you. The personalness is you. See what I mean?
Yeah. And this you, it's not a bigger consciousness.
It's not bigger because it doesn't have to do with time and space. That's an interesting... When you do a meditation, it's nice, I say meditation because you're just slowing everything down so you can notice these things. Notice and see if you're just your presence, when you're relaxing your mind and, you know, pulling really away from all of the sensory data that we're normally getting. And then you just let your mind ask yourself, you know, what size am I for your being? Do I have any boundaries? Am I any particular color? Do I have an up and a down or sides? These questions are totally irrelevant. You know, they're irrelevant for Ishwar and they're irrelevant for you. Because time and space belong and duality belong to the creation, not to consciousness. That's why it's interesting to play with your imagination. Like I can say, imagine a little meadow or imagine a big meadow. You know, why don't you just imagine a universe? It doesn't make any difference to consciousness. It's not that consciousness spreads out, you know, to become, you know, to gain the size of the universe. But whatever size of the universe is there, that isn't away from consciousness. Right? But consciousness itself has no size because Advaita, one without a second. There's no extension when there's no second thing. See what I mean? It's not like... If you think of consciousness becoming big, then there has to be a right side and a left side. There has to be extension. Extension into what? Then you have to bring space into it. But space is an element. Space belongs to Maya. So if you have extension, you have space. You know? If you have change, you have time. Time and space belong to the creation. Just think, now you imagine a meadow with its trees and sky and sun and all of that. All of that extension comes with the meadow imagination. It's not like the meadow comes into the extension of space. It's that space is part of the meadow. Right? So this whole creation, the time, space, change, everything belongs to the Maya Upadi, to the whole manifestation. The elements are space, air, fire, water, earth. Not fire, water, earth. And space then is the Brahman or something. Space is one of the elements that create the dimension of the picture of the creation. But so you take all of the space, air, fire, water, earth away, and then you are. Then what size are you? What dimension are you? These things are totally don't apply. And then you think, well, am I non-existent? Then you're the last thing you are is non-existent. You are the existence that the whole universe enjoys. The being of everything. The being of everything is not an object that you can look at. Well, look at the being. But there is nothing here but being. And that being is you. Mm. See, even when you say non-dual, that reality is non-dual, one without a second, that means it's you, or you're not here. Right? There's nothing else. So it must be you, right? Or you are not. But you are, so. But it's just that you are the self of everything. And all of this mithya is something that's coming and going in being.
So size is not there. How about being unequal? There's another concept of...
A better you?
Something's more equal or less, not equal to. Mm. That's still with the world of duality of objects.
Yeah, and the world is so unequal.
Yeah.
It's unequal, and it's even unfair in the short term.
Yeah.
You have to have a longer span to think of the world in terms of justice.
Yeah. No, but even in the self, you apply that concept you have in the world to your being, and there's
like, is there a better Atma?
Yeah,
better
a more accomplished Atma, or yeah. Not accomplished, but a grander, or you know, those kind of notions.
Yeah, there can't be any such thing in that which, you know, isn't objectifiable. There aren't any parts. There's no room for two. You need space to have two, also. But if you just remove space, and then where can there be two? It's not possible.
And also, there won't be something better from a person that is actually looking for a truth than a person that is just living his life and not seeking.
No, that's the same self.
They're the same.
Absolutely
so,
same.
Actually, the grasping of sometimes wanting somebody else to change is collapsing, because he's also kind of like just a manifestation, the same, like, as a seeker is a manifestation.
You know, you may want to help them change if they want you to help them change because they're in pain or something. But from the standpoint of the self, they're the same self, you know. And you know, I also think a lot of the people that there are many different people in your life, and you're one of them, right? You know, and there's different ways that all of us are called upon in any given moment to help each other, or certain responsibilities we have, or we're just called upon in certain ways all of the time, you know. But that's not from the standpoint of yourself. The Atma, yourself, is the one who's always the same amidst all of that. But within this relative world, there's all kinds of things we're called upon to do to help others, you know. But I think once you, when you have knowledge that motivation is you help others because they want some help, or you're in a position to do that, and that's what they want. But it's not that I want you to change to help me out. You may want that, but yeah. But then you kind of know the kind of the mid-depth of that. Those are those things that you let go, you know. And then eventually don't ask other people to be different than who they are. That's one of the great gifts you can give to humanity.
Yeah, that's what I meant. There is a letting go
of that need.
Need.
Your need for them to be different.
Yeah, because it's actually my need.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it's my need, you know, I'm Ishwara. So it's Ishwara's need, you know, if there's some pressure for something to change. Like, I don't know, sometimes I get uncomfortable with this as a way of talking about the self versus the mithya, which almost seems sometimes like this transcendentalism that is antithetical to things like social justice, things like feeling the pressure, feeling some need to respond to circumstances, you know, in one's life.
I think you have to be careful even with Vedanta and this kind of spiritual world in general, to keep the orders of reality straight, you know, because for instance yourself, the Atma is not having any social pressure. That it is what it is. Consciousness is non-dual. It's not having social pressure or the lack of it. It's not being lazy and it's not being active. It's just your being is as it is.
I'm talking about the level of Ishwara.
Yeah. No. But then, okay, so then within the level of Ishwara, there's the objective reality. And within that objective reality, there's Dharma and Adharma. Okay, so the Adharma you will feel as a jiva when you're going against the order. You know, when you're going with the order, if you're going with your Prarabdha Karma, where you're going along with the order of what is right, or the order of the golden rule, you know, which is something that is kind of there in all of the different religions. That type of ahimsa, that type of non-injury, or don't do to others as you wouldn't have done to yourself, and do to others as you would want done to yourself. Those are just overarching dharmas. And so, if we're not personally following that dharma, you know, and we're a sensitive person, we can feel pressure to follow it, but and then change accordingly. On another level, I think what maybe you're talking about is there's a lot of strife in the world, and you may feel called by your prarabdha or who you are as a person to get involved in a particular way, where another person won't be called at all to get involved in that way. They'll be called to get involved in another way, you know, depending upon the prarabdha. Otherwise, we'd all be involved in the same way to solve, you know, the same problem.
The nature of prarabdha is such that you do want things to change. That seems like that's part of the objective reality. So I think there can just be this, while learning this knowledge, there can be this sense of split that arises, because I'm remembering that the truth of my being isn't wanting, isn't feeling pressure. But then there's this orientation brought about by the prarabdha, which involves wanting things to change because things don't seem okay. And so you want to bring about some harmony.
Right.
In some.
Well, that's absolutely.
Situation.
It's that. But when you're saying you don't want things to change, that's not really correct.
Well, I was just referring to what you were saying in conversation previously about not wanting other people to change. You know that.
No, that's not what I said. Not wanting other people to change so that I can be happy. So that's the problem there. Not that I want somebody to change, but if my ananda, my fullness, is dependent on their changing, that's the samsara. If I'm objective, if I know it's not good for the situation, it's better if we can make these adjustments and that adjustments. We're doing that all of the time. If that's objective, then there's no problem. But if my well-being is dependent on it, my happiness is dependent on it, then that's a problem for me and for others. You know, with a desire template, the desire template goes like this. I want this. And that's desire. I want this. But what makes the desire problematic is I want this so that I can be happy. If it's just I want this, you know, and if I don't get it, that's fine. But I want this, I'm going to take the steps to get it. You say that's my prarabdha, that's my mission, that's my calling. I want this, I want to accomplish this. But if every time it's not going exactly how you want to, then you get bummed out or unhappy, then that's the samsara. There's no objectivity there.
What about I recognize the wholeness, the fullness, I can access that experience, that knowledge, but at the same time, I know that this is causing pain, and I want this because I want to alleviate that pain. I don't think that's going to make me whole and complete, but that seems like a very natural response. That's
yeah.
a healthy way of being in the world. But it does seem like it's closely related in the mind to happiness. You know, this pain gives my mind an experience of unhappiness. I don't take my mind to be what I am, but at the same time, do you know what I'm saying?
Sure. I mean, anytime, even if there's physical pain, there's going to be an urge to get rid of the physical pain because it's pain. If there's emotional pain or mental pain, there's going to be an urge, very natural urge, to get rid of that. But part of with knowledge is you have a deeper understanding of what the cause of that pain is. It's not that you don't want to get rid of it. Anytime that there's pain there, you want to get rid of it. But what is causing the pain? What are the attitudes? What is the childhood situation? What are the things that are causing the pain? And what is the best way to bring relief to it? This is a little bit different than what we were talking about in terms of how to be in the world in such a way that doesn't cause pain. So now say you are in pain, your mind is in pain. You know, then that becomes a sadhana, that becomes a point of reflection on really what is causing the pain and what is the best way, you know, to relieve that pain.
Comment was really just about how easily those levels, as you refer to them, get conflated. To how the mind's constantly trying to, in the light of trying to, you know, in the process of assimilating this knowledge, discern what is. Objective and what is subjective. You know what?
I just think that if something in your mind or body or world is causing you pain, then that requires some reflection to see what it is that's causing the pain. I mean, I think whenever there's pain there on any level, it's something that we want to heal. You know?
Yeah, and I don't know. I sometimes just think after so much time of, you know, studying this Vedanta, the problem of pain is still a huge human ongoing issue, and I start to wonder about how to reconcile the persistent nature of sukha-dukkha and that not just being a personal subjectivity, but this, you know, we're all so interrelated, and you can't just deal with what you consider to be some of your complexes or your childhood issues and then think, I'm going to be free from sukha-dukkha, because in the environment there's constantly things by which you're being sort of touched.
That's true. You know, they even say in the Brahma Sutras, when they're talking about Ishvara, that Ishvara also has what they call a dukkha-lesha, means a whiff of dukkha. Even though not identified with anything, you know, because there is dukkha there, because there's sorrow in the creation, you know, then that's, even though there's no identification with it, because you're the whole, you know, still there's a dukkha-lesha. Where, as for Brahman, from the standpoint of Brahman, there's no dukkha-lesha at all, because it's just awareness. There's no subject-object duality from the standpoint of consciousness. So consciousness is not suffering at all, ever, at any time. Consciousness is just consciousness. But from the standpoint of the creation, you know, dukkha is pervasive to the creation. And since the dukkha exists within Brahman, even though there's no identification with it, still there's a sense of sorrow that can come, that would be there. That's the discussion in the Brahma Sutras. But that's a lot different than, you know, identifying with the sorrow. And I feel that, so like, you know, I don't even, can't even watch these nature shows anymore. Because they're always killing the animal in some horrible way. Something awful is always... something's always happening, you know? I was noticing recently on the TV, you're watching a TV show, and then some terrible thing happens. It's just going... it's just going along, and then you're just blasted out of the water with this terrible thing. So, I mean, that universe is like that, you know? And it's not going to become otherwise, either.
Well, it hasn't yet, you know.
No, it hasn't yet. when you go back, way back, and you read some of the ancient epics, or you read the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and you go back, there's always, you know, these very painful events that are taking place. And so that's the very nature of Maya. So in spite of all the painful events that are there, there's someone who's free of that, and that's also true. It's the nature of the self, you know. Some people think, you know, that you gain... I used to joke about this often, you know. You gain self-knowledge, you become a great jnani. You know? Crossed over into the land of jnaniness. And then the world also becomes nice.
Yeah, like a pure heaven.
Yeah, it becomes nice. Especially to you. Because you're a jnani. It doesn't become nice. But maybe the way that you hold it is quite a bit different.
Could you actually... Like, so from that point of view you're talking, would you then actually experience the pain of the environment of somebody else? Actually experiencing it, but you still don't identify with it. I mean, is that both possible? I mean, could you have like, I mean, you see something in the environment that kind of really hits you, you know? I mean, would you have the physical experience of it?
And I think you can, and it's kind of like riding on water, though, that there's no one who's building up on it. But that doesn't mean that you don't have perceptions and feelings.
Right, you wouldn't make a story out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but yeah. You still would have the impact of it.
You have the feeling, yeah. You can have the feelings come... You know, from situations in the environment and other person's suffering, or from your own suffering also. Mm. Internal suffering, you know, from whatever causes. Are we done? No, I don't think we're quite done, but I think we're done enough.